This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Now, tonight we have one sponsor for the show, and that's our good friends at Jam Software. We'll tell you more about their product as the show goes on. Bradley, how are you doing?
Good, good. Got a good horror story, technology horror story for you.
Okay.
So this story starts like last week when I cracked my phone for the very first time. I'm not sure if I mentioned that on our last show. I don't think I did. I don't think we recorded since then.
Yep.
So I don't know how I cracked it. I didn't drop it. But I have my theory is I had a teacher that showed me one of those like lens clips attachments for iPhone. And it's kind of snaps onto your... Like, it clips onto your screen, and I think that put some pressure on the exact spot that it broke, because I didn't drop it. So, anyways, that's neither here nor there. And we don't have an Apple store within 2 hours of us, so Apple sent me a new phone. Or not a new phone, but I assume some sort of refurbished phone. I don't know, it looked pretty new, though. So I paid, like, $150, and they sent me a phone. I had to send my cracked one back. So, in that process, I went to restore my phone from iCloud. And as a side note, no more regret running public betas than when you have to restore your iPhone from iCloud, because you have to go through this, like, set it up as new, update to the beta, and then restore again. So it's kind of a pain. But anyways, so I go to restore it. And I have a unique Apple ID set up, probably like a lot of you listeners, and maybe you, Fraser. Well, I have this old Apple ID that is tied. It was like my original iTunes purchase like account. And for the longest time, it was just like a username. It wasn't even an email address. They forced me to change that last year. It literally was Bradley Chambers for a very long time. Now it's tied to like a random email address because I use my, you know, my iCloud email is my main personal email. But again, that's its own Apple ID. So you can't obviously mix them. Well, thankfully, like iOS handles this very well over the, you know, over the years. So like you can be signed into iCloud in one account, and then your like App Store and purchases can come from another account.
Yeah, and he even promotes that in the setup assistant. There's a button you can press that says use separate. Yeah,
yeah, and it really works out well, and it even stores like the app history in with the iCloud, because like it prompts you to then say, hey, you need to authenticate with this account. And it really works out well. Family sharing, because like I can share all my purchases from like the old account, even though like the main master account is my, you know, iCloud account, which is obviously more modern. In a perfect world, everything would have just been under that iCloud account. I should have done that because like I had .Mac, so like I have a .Mac email, and I feel like that's like I don't know, like some sort of like badge of honor when you have the .Mac email.
Yeah, old school concert T-shirt. Yeah.
So I go to restore and type in my iCloud account. It says, hey, you need to authenticate this account. I type in the wrong password like 4 times. I'm like, this, something's not right here. Like this, like it's just not working. Well, turns out I was typing in the wrong password. Like I have my Apple IDs, the passwords memorized. They're very, like they're random if you look at them. But to me, they are sentences in my brain. Does that make sense? So yeah, if it was like, Fraser Spears is a smart guy, you know, I might pick like the first letter of each of those words and add some numbers to it. Like, and it looks nonsensical, but it makes sense in my head. So that's how my Apple IDs are. Sadly, because you have to type them in so many times, even day to day, for some reason it would just randomly ask for that. So anyways, I go and I'm locked out. So I go on the computer, I'm trying to unlock it. And of course, it's in 1Password. And that's when I realize I'm typing it in wrong. Just a parent brain fart, I guess. Well, so it says it's locked. It's like, okay. And this account has the old version of like two, I don't know, I can't, I always forget it, 2-factor and 2-step. So like the way Apple set up now with like the extra security is it like sends a code to all your authenticated devices. Well, the old style, like it was, you know, I think on iOS 8 and below, is it send a code to a text message, like a cell phone number. So that account was on that old one, because honestly, it's hard to migrate it to the new style if you're not using it as an iCloud account. And so it sends me a text message, just to get that, and I'm going to log in. It says, this account has been locked, just like to repeated attempts. Use your recovery key to unlock it. And so the way a recovery key is something you get to when you set up on two-factor, and you must keep that. Like, it's like, hey, print this out and like put it somewhere, like with your will or something. Well, I have all my recovery keys printed out with my will. Do we keep in a very, very safe place? I do not have that one. So, but then here's the thing. I remember the password. That's the thing. So if you look at Apple's like website for all this, you must remember two of the three. You must have a registered device, which I do have. You must remember the password, which I do have. And then you must, or the recovery key. But like, so I have two of those. So like the account's locked out. So I call Apple. Like, her lady is like, does not know what she's like. She just clearly, she even admits like, I've never dealt with this before. And I imagine because this is like the old security thing, like so maybe she's new and like they never had any training on it because you can't even set this up anymore. So she quickly gets me like kind of kicked up the chain. The guy's like, oh, wow, this is a weird edge case. I've never seen this before because, again, I know I would be totally hosed if I didn't remember the password. But I remember the password, but it just won't let me type in the password. So he like, okay, I got to log a ticket with engineering and et cetera, et cetera. He's like, it might be a day or two. Of course, this is really frustrating because I can't, my phone's like unusable. My new phone's unusable. And I need to send the other one back. And so he calls me back like 30 minutes later and is like, yeah, you're screwed. Like there is just like nothing we can do. And so what this means is I have lost the access to my Apple ID, which contains every purchase I've ever made. Oddly enough, like that's not a huge problem for me in reality.
You seem remarkably relaxed about this, I have to say.
Well, because if I look at my phone, like so, all my music, music doesn't have DRM, so like I have all offline copies of anything I've ever bought. And then if you have streaming services, like who even cares? I honestly have not bought that many movies or TV shows from iTunes that I tend to want to rewatch. We rent most of them. We just don't watch many movies. The more annoying thing is I had like $70 worth of iTunes credit on there. And if I look at my like apps on my phone right now, majority of them are not paid. Like they're mostly like apps for services I pay for. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, all right, well, this really sucks, but let's just do this. And so I go through and I set it up as new and now I'm going to be using my iCloud account as the purchase account. So like I end up having to buy maybe $20 worth of apps and it's like, Fantastic Owl, $5. Deliveries, $5. Like Dark Sky, $3, $4. I mean, it's like piddly. And just like, and I go through, like the iCloud family sharing thing. I change the purchases to come to from my iCloud account rather than my like old account. And one thing I do as well is go in and disable any recurring subscription I had. So like I had an Apple Music family plan that I was getting ready to cancel anyways and let my wife just sign up on her own because I've moved to Spotify and like my Overcast subscription and some things like that. Because the thing is like I don't have, if I send this phone back, like the computer requires me to type in the password to turn these subscriptions off. So I'm like worried if I don't turn them off now, I won't get them turned off without having to basically like cancel my credit card. Because in a perfect world, I would just like let these subscriptions run and eat up that credit. And the cool thing is too, like a lot of these apps, even if like, like Overcast, for example, and this is smart on the developer's part. So like I made the purchase on one Apple ID, the year subscription for, file uploads, but it records that I made that purchase on my iCloud account. So like Overcast recognized that I already paid. And a lot of the apps were that way. Like it's like they had kind of synced that purchase with an iCloud ID.
Yeah, they're kind of saving the fact that you did purchase in your settings in some way, aren't they?
Correct. So that saved me big time. It's really annoying. Get it all set up. And, I got a couple apps on the Mac I have to rebuy. But most of them, like the apps will still run. And so like I basically just like signed out of the old Apple ID, signed into the new one. And whatever. Just let it be. I'm probably at $20 at this point, plus if you count that credit. So, go to bed. That's where we're at. It's kind of annoying. Like, I just kind of feel stupid because it's totally my fault. Like, it's nobody's fault but mine.
Yeah, it's a kind of avoidable problem, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So, go to bed. It's, like, just annoying. It's like, all right, it's what it is. I'm not going to, like, worry. Honestly, when I was going to bed, I was realizing, like, my kids have, like, some of these Lego games I'm going to have to rebuy eventually. Mm. And I mean, honestly, the whole thing will end up costing me $150 probably when it's all said and done. Like if you count that credit,
it's not the most costly software problem there's ever been, is it?
It's not. No, it's not. So that's Act 1. Act 2 is I wake up the next morning. Yeah, there's more. There's more. So Act 2 is and throughout this process, like I found some random recovery keys like in one password, and like I keep trying all of them. It finally says like basically like you're timed out. Like it's and the guy tells me that okay, you have to wait like 8 hours before you can enter anything else. It's gotta like reset itself. Because again, the situation is like I'm in this weird state of lockout. Because it's like I have the password, but it won't let me enter it. So I wake up the next morning. This is like 5 p.m. Wake up the next morning, 5 a.m. I kind of forget about it. I'm making coffee. I'm like, oh, you know, I should just like see what happens if I try to log in. It let me in.
No.
I get back into the Apple ID. So I'm like, oh. So I bought all these apps for nothing. So the cool thing is, like, most of those apps, honestly, have gone way too long without paid updates. And so I'm completely fine giving them, like, you know, like deliveries. Like, that is a fantastic app. And it has, like, a cloud syncing service. I'm fine to give him $5. Dark Sky, haven't paid for that in, like, 5 years. Fine to give them $4. So then what I do is I sign out or reset my phone, restore from iCloud backup. Because, again, I had to set it up from scratch. Yeah, the night before, I had to literally set it up from scratch. And so then I have to reset it again, restore from my iCloud backup from like, you know, yesterday, the day before at like 2, and it all works. Everything's back to normal. I go in there. I do turn off two-factor authentication, mainly because I can't move to the new one and that the way I'm using it. And it's like, it's a long password. I'll just risk it. Now, the kicker is like one thing that broke is my like family sharing thing. I think you have to wait 90. Like I changed it back to the old account where it shares purchases, but I think you have to wait 90 days before that takes effect because my wife's iPhone was not recognizing that we had an active Apple Music subscription. So what I did is I was already going to cancel that anyways because she was going to keep Apple Music and I've moved to Spotify. And she was able to sign up for a 3-month free trial. And then I bought her, you can buy like a 12-month code, like off eBay or even go to Target. You can buy a $99 12-month Apple Music. So it's not even like iTunes credit. You can redeem it as iTunes credit, but it basically like, I did it a little while ago. She has like Apple Music paid up for through like March of 2018. Cause it doesn't basically use that credit until the 3-month free trial's up, but it's not even like it's regular iTunes credit where app purchases would eat into it. Like it's literally just extended her account until May of 2018.
Yeah, I think we recommended that on the Christmas show, didn't we? That was a nice way to do it. Yeah.
Unfortunately, it doesn't work with the family plan. Like I wish you could just I like to pay for stuff yearly. And so it's nice. Like we just paid for her Apple Music yearly and I've got Spotify paid up for, I think, till September. So that's that fun story. So the moral of this is if you have like two-factor stuff turned on, make sure you know where your recovery keys are. So what I've done is the things I have that turned on, I went in and like revoked all the codes, made new ones, and printed them out. So my this is like my Gmail account, my two administrator work Gmail accounts, and like Dropbox. And I think that was the other big thing. That was the big thing I had the recovery keys on. And what this has really told me, this is why you just should never trust a cloud service with the only copy of your photos. Because imagine if this was my regular iCloud account and I didn't have local copies of my photos.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you would be screwed.
Yeah, and Apple are pretty sort of tight about, you know, getting past those blocks at times, aren't they? You know, they can... I don't know if it's deliberately designed in such a way that nobody at Apple can fix it for you, but, you know, at some point they will just say, nope. And that's
what that said. I mean, he said, you know, the thing about taking the human interaction out of this is it's way more secure, but you have these edge cases where like you just have to tell people like, I'm sorry. And so this is why I always, always will still recommend, you know, even if you use iCloud Photo Library, you need to have a copy somewhere of this stuff, like local copy, not in a cloud service. Because, yeah, you know, we always talk about like companies going out of business. Like, what if you lose access to your account for some reason like this?
Man. Doesn't bear thinking about it, does it?
Yeah. So thankfully, happy ending. I probably was out $20 when it was all said and done on apps I rebought that didn't need to. And honestly, had I been more patient and just waited till the next morning to start setting my phone back up, it wouldn't have happened. But you know, you're like me. You would have done the same thing.
Absolutely.
So, before we get, we can move on from there, but before we get going, I want to thank our sponsor for the night. Mm-hmm. It's the great folks at Jamf. Jamf Pro is a solution for deploying, managing, and securing Apple devices. Over 3 million students are empowered by Jamf every day. Bring learning to a whole new level for your students by providing the tools they need to be successful in today's classroom. Start a free trial at jamf.com. That's JAMF.com. So good Jamf story before we get rolling. I was making, for some reason I couldn't get a configuration profile sent out. Like it kept failing. It's mm-hmm. he's like bundle identifier missing. So I called the guys up at Jamf and they're awesome. And they were just like, honestly, it is way faster just to recreate their profile than it is to figure out why this is broken. So mm-hmm. I did that, but I accidentally hit the button that says do not allow apps. I was like in the media restrictions tab. And it was like, yep. So like I got my phone started ringing. Where are all the apps? And like they were just gone. And so Z obviously fixed it within seconds and it doesn't remove them. It just hides them, which is thankful.
Yeah.
And so I just walked around to make sure people were good. And I said, students, this shows y'all that Mr. Bradley is all powerful.
Yeah. Sometimes you just want to have a show of strength, you know, roll your tanks through the streets just so people know what you can do.
Yeah. I know what's up. So anyways, yeah, we had fun with that. I apologize. That was my fault. And I've done that before. I just always forget, like, cause you're just like doing music and movies and TV shows. And then apps is the fourth one. It's like, do not allow apps and they're all gone.
So anyway, let's move on to some more positive things. I thought we would talk a little bit about Swift Playgrounds again.
Yes.
We've mentioned it before. But obviously, the last time we mentioned it, I looked back in our shows, and the last time we mentioned it was just as it was out, which was last October when iOS 10 came out and Swift Playgrounds shipped out with it. There's been a number of changes and other things have gone on since then, and I thought it would be worth revising it because also we at Cedars have been... I have been teaching with Swift Playgrounds since October, really. So I thought I would maybe share some of my kind of experience with teaching it as well and just kind of let people know what's good, what's bad, what to look out for if you're thinking of bringing Swift programming into your school.
Yeah, absolutely, because I think a lot of people, as they're starting to make curriculum decisions for next year, this is when it's really going to be top of mind. If you didn't want to deploy it mid-year, basically.
Yeah, we were kind of lined up because we had a... We start in August, so we had August to October. That's kind of one half term for us. And then we sort of knew roughly when iOS 10 was coming out, so we were ready to kind of get started just as soon as. And really, I suppose we should, for people who are not familiar with the whole thing, we should kind of lay out the landscape of everything that Apple's doing around about coding in schools at the moment, because there's quite a lot of different moving parts, and people are often, when I talk to them about it, they're a bit kind of confused about what part is what. And the term that Apple uses is everyone can code. And that name refers to the overall company-wide push to help and support schools and teachers and children to learn to program in Swift in school. That's not just the name for the iPad programming stuff. It also covers the stuff they've done for the Mac as well. It covers under the Everyone Can Code program. That's where you get Swift Playgrounds, you get the Learn to Code curriculum and so on. So there's a number of different bits and pieces all under that one banner of Everyone Can Code. And the first one, obviously, is the Swift Playgrounds app itself, which is kind of the flagship feature, I think. That was the bit that got keynote time at WWDC last year. The app is really quite fantastic. We'll talk a little bit more about the app in detail, but for a 1.0 version, what they've done with that app is pretty phenomenal. Then you've got the Learn to Code books, which are books that are built into the Swift Playgrounds app. And there are now 3 of those books. There were 2 at the start. Well, there was 1 at the start, and then there's another one came out just very quickly afterwards. And then Learn to Code 3 came out a little bit later on. And those are essentially a computer science, or at least a coding curriculum, if not maybe a full computer science curriculum, in 3 different parts. And I've taught all of Learn to Code 1. I've taught half of Learn to Code 2 so far, and pretty soon we'll be doing Learn to Code 3 with one of the classes as well. Alongside that, you've also got Swift Challenges. Okay, so these are like shorter books that are built with the same technology as Learn to Code 1, 2, and 3, but they're shorter, they're maybe more focused on one particular aspect of programming or something like that. But they're quite useful in the class for things like extension work when people are finished early and things like that. But really crucially, actually, there's also a set of teacher guides. And this is something, I was talking to one of our science teachers today, and she was saying that they'd been doing a STEM project with a local university, and it had been really difficult because what these STEM projects tend to do is they get a box of electronics and they send it to schools. And it's, this problem's not really getting the electronics as much as somebody knowing what to do with the electronics once they get there. So I showed her all of the stuff that Apple had done with teacher guides for everyone can code. And she was like, oh, that's amazing. That's what I wish we had for all the STEM stuff that we're doing. So the teacher guide is actually really, really good. And, you know, if you don't have a computer science education background or something, I'm not saying you could pick up that guide and be amazing at it on the first day, but it would get you through the course. You know, you'd be a few pages ahead of the pupils, and you would understand what you're trying to get them to do. But what I strongly think about it is that you wouldn't, if you ended up with somebody in your class who was actually really good at it, they would probably outpace you quite quickly, because the teacher guide doesn't go into extension detail, if you like. It doesn't go into background information. It sort of just tells you, here's what this lesson should be, here's how to help the children think about it and stuff. The usual teacher guide stuff, but it's very useful for that. That's not a criticism of it. It's just that's the level of content that's in it.
Well, and that's the, we've discussed that in the past. That's the conundrum you have here when it says everybody can code. But I mean, can everybody teach coding?
Well, that's the claim Apple are making, right? Is that I've been to one of the roadshow events about this as well, and the Apple education team stood up at that event, and they actually literally said, we think everyone can learn to code, and we also think everyone can learn to teach coding as well. Which I was kind of like, interesting point, right? So what you're saying is that my job is the one that everybody can do. Okay, fine. So the teacher guide is good, right? Don't get me wrong, but you know.
Well, and that's something to, and that's like a larger discussion of, like, I'm trying to think of a good example here. I mean, it's like, if you've got someone that, let's use sports. Like, if you got someone that played soccer or football, depending on which country you're in, played their whole life, and like that's like, you know, went to school and learned about that, studied the rules, and is like trained for that entire life. Can someone? I mean, like. Obviously, they would be able to coach it and teach it very well. Can someone that watch some videos like about the fundamentals like learn it? I guess, but I'm not certainly not dismissing the content. I'm just saying like I think I don't know if disrespectful is the word, but and I think what you said is there. It's like there's a difference between being able to teach the lessons and understanding like why the lessons exist.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not precious about it in that way, but I sort of think that, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, we spend a lot of time in education dealing with children at the lower end of the ability range, but sometimes, just occasionally, you get somebody in your class who's at the upper end of the ability range, and sometimes I wonder, like, are we doing as good a job for those pupils at the other end of the spectrum as we are, you know, the amount of money and time and effort that's put into children who really struggle with learning? And particularly in computer science, you occasionally get the one person who really clicks with it, and they are, you know, I've had one pupil recently who, you know, they're really challenging me in my teaching and my understanding, and they're giving me solutions to these problems that I have to really sit down and think about, is that solution correct? Is there a way that I can stretch this person to do better, you know, and all of those things, and I'm having to work pretty hard to keep up with the kids, I suppose, or with one or two particular pupils. And that's an interesting challenge. And we spent some time at one of the recent Swift summits talking with some of the other teachers who had been teaching this stuff about at what point would somebody who doesn't have a background in computer programming, what point would they drop off in terms of being able to support the pupil through additional learning or extension learning or something like that.
Yeah, because you are feeling challenged and you have a computer science background.
It's an interesting problem, because I think in certainly in secondary school, every teacher of every subject has at one point had a pupil who is better than them. And that's what happens in that situation, is a bit of a personality thing, I think, as well as a learning thing as well. So, yeah. So that's the teacher guide anyway. There's lots to be said about that. And I think the teacher guide in general is very good. And certainly for most teachers, it will be a great help in helping them structure their pupil's progression through the course. What else is there? There's an iTunes U course. So if you go into iTunes U, there's a sort of learn to code course that you can look at as a... You can't take a copy of it and run it as your own course, but you can sort of use it as a maybe as a guide to what you might put in your own iTunes U course about Swift. But the things that are very new since we last spoke about this topic are, one, they're now doing learn to code sessions at the Apple Store. So you can, you know, you can sign up for like Final Cut and things like that at the Apple Store. You can now also sign up for Swift Playgrounds there as well. So that's an interesting new part to it. And then I don't know if you've looked at Apple Teacher, Bradley.
Yeah, I have a little bit.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think it's interesting. I mean, I think it's like the way it coexists alongside like the ADE. I mean, mm-hmm. it does seem like they're branching this out and offering different ways to kind of certify yourself.
Yeah, the Apple Teacher program has only just come out in the UK, so I've only recently, since January, I think it has, been able to have a look at the actual content of it. But for people who are not familiar with both of these programs, the ADE program, the Apple Distinguished Educator program, is... it's a recognition program for teachers who have done quote-unquote outstanding things with Apple technology in the classroom. And ADE is based on you apply to become one and you show evidence of what you've done and you are selected to become an ADE based on some criteria and a little bit of... I always use the phrase beauty contest and people think I'm really being disdainful when I say that, but I'm not. It's just... You know, it's you're selected from a bunch of candidates, and you think about it that way. It's sort of what I mean. Whereas Apple Teacher is much more of a kind of certification program based on your actual knowledge, and in that sense, it's a little bit more like the Google Certified Teacher program that's been out for a while. In that, what you do is you answer questions about the technology, and then when you get those badges, you kind of make progress with it. And what I think is really interesting about Apple Teacher is. That it's very accessible to everybody. I mean, like for listeners to this show and for people like you and I, and certainly anybody who's an Apple Distinguished Educator, you can just go in and answer the questions and pass it straight away because it's not that complicated. But for, you know, there are a lot of teachers who are new to Apple technology and new to Apple platforms that those questions, and there's a number of help guides and things for teachers there. Going through all of those materials and getting those badges will be quite an achievement for some teachers. And what I've seen already online is, like, you know, whole schools or whole departments in schools making it kind of like a focus of professional development for a while for everybody to become an Apple teacher. And I think that's that's probably the most powerful thing that you could do with Apple Teacher is to have a kind of push in your school for many people or everybody to become an Apple teacher, because for those people, if you're starting a one-to-one program where you're starting Swift coding as a practice in your school, I think that that's one of the ways in which you could really put the focus on that for a little while and really kind of build it into your school culture. And then, of course, you've got to move on from that in time to come. But at a certain point in a school's development with technology, I think that's a really good way to use that whole part of it.
You know, that could be something that the fall or the spring before you do a one-to-one program, that could be kind of your groundwork you could do, is that push everybody, okay, before we do this, let's all become Apple certified teachers. That's a great idea.
Yeah, that's one of the strongest things I think I've seen. And it's all about building that culture because you're kind of engaged in that culture change aspect of it, I think. And that's, we've talked about that many, many times in the show before. But so that's the overview of Everyone Can Code. It's taken me quite a while to even talk through it because there's a lot of different things. You got the Swift Playgrounds app. You get the Learn to Code program. You've got the Swift Challenges. There's a teacher guide for Learn to Code. There's an iTunes U course. You can go to a coding session at the Apple Store, and you can become an Apple teacher. And once you get through the basics of Apple Teacher, there are then badges for Swift programming as well. So you can actually get badged on Swift as well as just the kind of basics of GarageBand or Pages or whatever as well. So those are some of the cool things. I thought I might drop in, Bradley, a little bit about my experience with teaching alongside that. And specifically, you know, really, I think what is really interesting is the app and the Learn to Code curriculum, because those are the kind of two tools that if you're going through this as a program, you will kind of, those are the bits you touch every single day. So the app in general has been very usable and very stable. One of the main features of the app is that it has a code editor built into it, where you can do things like you can kind of do drag and drop editing with the syntax of Swift. So you can press a button and it puts in a loop for you, and then you can sort of drag the bottom bracket of the loop to, you know, enclose or exclude code from being inside the loop. And a lot of that stuff has been really useful, but just occasionally it is a little bit buggy, and sometimes you try and delete one part of the code and it deletes everything that was there and things like that. So we found a few issues around with that. But one of the nice ways that they've done it is they've made it drag and drop. And they've also, you know how when you type on iOS, you get the autocorrect suggestions on the top of the keyboard? Well, with Swift Playgrounds, what it does is it gives you suggestions for code that you can use to complete your program. And it's context sensitive, which means that it only offers you suggestions that are valid to write in the place where your cursor is. So if you've tapped in between an if statement and a bracket, it only gives you things that are legal to put in that line of code. Or if you said, you know, variable equals blank, then in that blank, you're only given options for things that are legal to say, like an integer or a true and false value or something like that. It doesn't let you put in just any random code. And that's been really helpful. And the experience I've had with that is that when you teach kids to program, quite often they spend a lot of time just figuring out how to type in a legal sentence in the language or a legal statement in the language, and often get it very wrong. So this whole system really supports kids to type in correct code in the first place, so that they have a high probability of their code running correctly the first time, or at least their code running the first time. Maybe there are logic issues, that still happens, but they don't have just syntax error after syntax error after syntax error all the time. And that's enabled a lot of kids to move really quickly from knowing nothing to writing legal Swift code. Not always correct Swift code, but at least Swift code that runs, produces a result, and then they can start to see, what did I do wrong? Well, it was a thinking problem. It wasn't just a typing problem. That kind of stuff has really been helpful.
I mean, you think about it, it would be like the equivalent. Think about how we teach, like, reading. You know, you don't hand somebody a, you know, chapter book for the first thing. Like, you have to, you would never, people would get so frustrated, they would never read.
Yeah.
Would there, you progress them up and you help them, you give them wins early on. Like, you start with the basics, but then you also do it in such a way where, like, they, you know, feel like they're accomplishing something.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting, what I've noticed with the kids is that they sort of forget that there's a keyboard available as well, because the way that Playgrounds works, when you tap on the code editor, unlike most iOS apps, the keyboard doesn't come up automatically. The keyboard only comes up when you press a button to bring the keyboard up. So quite often what happens is the kids they're so kind of focused on using this suggestions bar that if something happens where there are no suggestions, they forget that they could just type the code in, you know. So it's you have to sort of say, well, remember there's a keyboard, yeah. Why not try typing in, you know? We've seen a couple of issues as well where the parser will crash while the kids are programming, and it won't be able to offer any suggestions. It just says no suggestions available. And usually the fix for that is to close the book and reopen the book, and it fixes itself. But sometimes the kids sort of look at that and they're just stalled because they don't know what they can do. In that situation, you can still type in the code, but they've kind of been trained at this stage just to use the corrections and or use the suggestions, and that's something I'm trying to kind of get through to them as well. You could just type if you want to, you know, that's okay too. But in general, the app has been great. The app can do some stuff that we haven't really used very much of yet, and I'm still trying to think of what's the best way to do this. But I saw an example another teacher had done from another school where one of the things you can do is Swift Playgrounds integrates. There's an API in iOS that lets games record the screen while you play, and then you can use it. You can either live broadcast it through a certain app, or you can save the video for later. And Swift Playground supports that. So what you can do is that you can type your code in, then hit record and run your code, and you could submit a video of your code working. And I thought that was quite an interesting idea. And I'd seen one teacher where what he did was he had the kids work through a whole section in the book. And once they had completed the section, what they would do is they would go back to the first solution, and they would hit record, and they would play back their solution, go to the next one, play that one back, play that one back. So for every section in the book, the Learn to Code 1 and 2 book, they would submit one video to his iTunes U course, which he would watch, and he would see the code that they had submitted running through over and over again, which I thought, well, that's quite an interesting way to do it. And of course, you could scrub through the video and things to make sure, you know, review things or look at them again or whatever. So that was an idea. One I've not tried yet, but it's something that's interesting potential for the future, I think.
Yeah, that is neat. Just you can think of all kinds of neat options there with that, being able to record that screen on just lots of apps, actually.
Mm, yeah, I kind of think, well, why isn't that just a system feature, you know, that you could just record the screen in any app? You know, wouldn't that be cool? But I also thought, you know, say you were teaching this programming system and you were doing it maybe remotely, like you were teaching somebody through an iTunes U course where you were never actually together in the same room at the same time. That would be a great way to submit bugs for feedback. It's like, I've got the solution here. It doesn't run properly, but here's a video of what it does when it runs. Can you help me figure it out? You know, and that's another way that you could work with that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe an iOS 11 feature, because that kind of feature has been a long time coming, being built in.
Yep. Yeah, you got to go and buy a Mac just to record the screen of your iPad. I don't think so.
Speaking of that, I kind of did hear there's a way for the Apple Store people or the AppleCare people to remotely control your iOS screen.
Really?
That there's an app. They have an app. Mm. I forget who told me that. Like the AppleCare can like remotely assist you and see your screen.
I know there's one for the Mac, but I wasn't aware there's one for iOS yet. But, you know, there's clearly some infrastructure for that, because how does Apple Classroom work otherwise, you know? Classroom is just a viewer, of course, but, you know, it's not outside the bounds of possibility to accept input that way as well. Okay, so that's the app. The app is great. A couple of other tips that I found with the app. One is that you can have, if you have the Learn to Code book in your app, you can duplicate the book. And then what it will do is it will offer you the opportunity to reset the book when you duplicate it. So I teach two levels, and what I have is I have one copy of the book for each of the classes, right? So I've got two classes, both going through Learn to Code 1, and then they'll go through Learn to Code 2. So I've got the first year book of each one, and I've got the second year book of each one. And I've also got a third copy, which is my solutions to all of the problems as I've written them as well. So that's something to bear in mind. It's not obvious that will work until you do it, but it's just the standard iOS, you know, you duplicate this file interface. But then when you do that, it will say, do you want to keep all your changes or do you want to reset them? And if you reset them, you get a second clean copy of the book that you can use. And I kind of use that to track where I've got to in each of the classes. I just open up the book from the last time we used it, and it's at the same page as it was before. So that's just another little tip for Swift Playgrounds.
That's a good idea.
So the curriculum is the next thing, and I think there's a couple of the three or four, I suppose, different areas of focus for each of the three different books. Learn to Code 1 really starts the kids off by looking at commands, just, you know, telling something on the screen to do something. Commands like move forward, turn left, turn right. It's all maze-based in the first couple of books, where you have a character that walks through a puzzle world doing various things as you go. So the kids are learning about things like sequencing and giving different commands and seeing the effects of those commands. And then it takes you into writing your own functions, so identifying little patterns in the world and writing code to solve those patterns and then composing that into a bigger solution. Then it teaches about loops, so you have repeated commands, repeated code, and then finally algorithms, which is looking at ways to generalize the problem of, say, moving around a maze that might be a square or something like that. So that's Learn to Code 1, and we've taught all of that, and for the most part, it's been very straightforward for almost all of the kids to learn how to do. Even kids who, you know, have learning challenges, they find things difficult. Everybody's finding some level of success through that. Some people are flying with it, other people are coping with it, some are just keeping up, but nobody is completely adrift with that so far, which is very interesting to me. Both of my classes have just moved on to Learn to Code 2, and in Learn to Code 2, you learn about things like firstly, variables, and then types, or objects as they're called in programming, and also parameterized functions. So the functions that you write in book one are just functions where you're grouping lines of code together. And then in book two, you learn how to adjust those to have parameters so that they can one function can do a range of different things based on what you pass into it and so on. Learning to code 3 is a little bit different. I haven't taught that yet, but I've looked at it, and in Learning to Code 3, what you do is you do things like handle touchscreen input and learn how to deal with arrays and things like that, more kind of advanced programming techniques as well. So I'm looking forward to doing that with the class as well. And my experience so far with Learning to Code 2 has been fine, except for, this is a kind of one of these edge cases that you sometimes come across in teaching, is there's one exercise where it's teaching about types. And in the maze, one of the features in the maze is a portal, which is like a little drain cover that the character, when it walks on, it goes down through and comes up the similarly coloured portal somewhere else in the world. And I had one student in the class who, the portals are distinguished by colour, so one is green and one is orange, and you can imagine where this is about to go. He just said, they all look the same to me. I said, what do you mean they all look the same? He said, well, I've got colour blindness and I can't tell which one is which. And all four of these portals look the exact same colour to me. And I was like, oh, hadn't thought about that. And so I had to just kind of help him by sketching a wee map and showing which portal connected to which other one. And then he could do it by position, but I had to kind of interpret it for him because he couldn't see the difference between the colour of the orange and the colour of the green that were used to separate those two parts of the map.
Well, it seems like that could be an opportunity, some sort of accessibility built into that app.
Yeah, I'm not sure how deep the accessibility goes in that. I think there's probably an opportunity to also just maybe redesign the shape of those or something, to have like a square portal and a round portal or something, as well as just color. True. As well. Yeah. So yeah, the curriculum so far has been great. I think most kids are coping very well with it. I wouldn't say that up to now we've really seen, I'm aware that there's a lot more of Swift, the language, than we are actually attacking right now. So we haven't really, although we're starting to look at objects, we haven't looked at writing our own classes, we haven't looked at using what are called structs or enumerations or anything like that. Type conversion, string handling, all of that stuff is still, and certainly any of the iOS API, some of that's mentioned in Learn to Code 3, but, view programming or anything like that, anything what iOS programmers might know of as iOS programming, none of that is touched. You're still very much programming inside the world of these books, which is fine for the level that we're dealing with, but one of the things Apple sort of suggests is that eventually you graduate from iPad and you go over to Xcode on the Mac, and there's a whole other course called App Development with Swift, which is built around Xcode and the Mac. So that's supposed to be like the next stage in your evolution as a Swift programmer. But of course, we don't have any Macs, so that's not where we're going to go. But that's, according to Apple, that's where you go after Learn to Code 3. At the moment, is you go to App Development with Swift on the Mac and you start hacking out your app there.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they've really, I mean, you think about this too. I mean, obviously this helps sell iPads, but this also could be helping the next generation of Apple developers, build them from the ground up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what I'm looking at right now is I'm trying to find ways to kind of enhance or expand the kind of things that we can do with Swift Playgrounds, because it can do much more than is covered in any of these courses here. So what I've been doing is I've been trying to write little individual playgrounds that can do different things. I had one that created like a 7-segment display on the screen, and you could program what number it showed and things like that. And also recently I got a drone and a Sphero robot, the little rolling ball thing. And there are, yes, Swift playgrounds that you can use to control both of those things. So we were flying the drone today in school. It's one of those Parrot mini drones. And you can actually program the drone with Swift code. So you can say things like, take off, move forward for 2 seconds, turn 180, land, whatever else. Some of the drones have got like a grabber on them. You can operate the grabber by code. So I'm looking at that, and I'm not really using it in class just yet, but I'm looking at maybe for next year, can I write some materials that go along with that are, different challenges or different scenarios that we can use to access hardware as well, and maybe some other things to do with maybe internet programming and things as well. I think there's far more you could do that's interesting with Swift Playgrounds on the iPad without having to sort of, abruptly switch to the Mac to go any further with it.
Well, you've done it. You figured out a way to expense a drone out at work.
Finally done it. Yeah. And I managed to cut myself in the hand with it as well. So we're probably going to have to do a full risk analysis before we can put the drone into use in the classroom. But I can't imagine what could go wrong. You know, beginner programmers flying thing with whirling blades on it. What could go wrong? I don't know. Probably have to wear safety goggles to program there. That's what it's going to be. Just want to mention briefly also the Swift Challenges stuff, which is really cool because there's a kind of little built-in store inside Playgrounds where you can download the Learn to Code books, but you can also get these challenges. And these are great in the classroom because you'll get some kids who will solve a problem very quickly and others who will take longer, and you can use these challenges as like extension work for kids who are finished quickly. Just say, you know, pick a challenge and go and hack on that for a while. And they have, Apple kind of releases them every so often. And one just came out yesterday called Cypher, which I've not had a huge amount of time to deal with it yet. But it looks like it's kind of built around cryptography, which I think is a fascinating thing to bring to people, young people of that age. And it's sort of built a wee bit like a choose your own adventure game as well, where you kind of move through the adventure by writing code. So you provide different kinds of code and the book seems to behave a little differently. I think that could be quite a fun topic to open up for kids as well. These are the kind of things, right? It's as much a design problem, right? An instructional design problem as a code problem, because you've got such kind of rich and beautiful graphics that you can do as well. And that's one of the things that's very attractive to kids about the Learn to Code series, is that it's all very attractive and very animated and so on. The level of design you can bring to these other problems probably needs to be a bit higher. You know, I find myself challenged compared to the kind of programming exercises I used to write, where it was like, you know, write a function that calculates the cost of a ticket, right? And put that up against what Apple have done with Playgrounds, and your kids are going to be rather unimpressed. So I think it raises the bar a little bit as well in terms of the level of interest and the level of richness that you can approach with the stuff that you do in the classroom there.
Ah, very cool. Sounds like it's, I mean, I guess, are you happy that you kind of implemented it on the fly and this year, instead of kind of sitting around waiting on, you know, just a complete summer to refresh your lesson plans?
Yeah, I think I am. What I've done in the early part is I've stuck very closely to Apple's Teacher Guide because I wasn't really familiar with the whole plan progression of it. So I kind of did what they wanted me to do. Or what they suggested that I do. And since that time, I've started to kind of move away from it a little bit. Once I know that I know the kids better, and I know, you know, what I know about programming better as well. But overall, what I think it's done, I think the key thing for me is that more kids are meeting more success more often with this curriculum than any previous curriculum that I've taught. And for me, that's super important. And I think that gives me something to build on in years to come as well. And I think I feel pretty confident that you can teach this material to kids of, let's see what ages are they, sort of 11, 12, 13. That's the kind of ages that I'm dealing with now for this stuff. And it's pretty successful overall. And I'm really pretty happy with what's happening in the classroom.
Well, very cool. I think it's, you know, there's no good time to release content like this, but I think, I mean, obviously the ideal time would be in the spring, but I think it was baked enough to where releasing in the fall with iOS 10, you know, they were able to, some early adopter teachers got it rolled out and implemented, and then helps everybody learn, and then they can kind of go, you know, this is like, you know, version 1.9 and like kind of 1.0 kicks off next school year kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fairly clear that's the timing that Apple's looking at, is really adoption in the school year 2017-18. I mean, it helped me, you know, Apple very kindly took me to WWDC in the summer, and I met with the team that worked on Playgrounds, the team that was writing Learn to Code and so on. And that was really helpful to get me up to speed really quickly. I mean, that week was an insane learning curve, really, to go from, oh, here's Monday afternoon where you're going to hear about this thing for the first time, and then by sort of Thursday afternoon, you're supposed to be the guy who's going to take this back and tell people about it, you know. But we got there, and that was useful for me, and that enabled me to kind of start earlier. But if you hadn't had that experience or that opportunity until iOS 10 came out, then, you know, there's not that many people who could adopt it quite that early. But I think now you've had from October to, you know, this summer coming, time to look at it, time to go through it. And Apple have had time to release another book in the meantime. You know, when iOS 10 came out, we only knew about Learn to Code 1 and 2, and we didn't know that even 3 was coming. And I think that if there's something that I could kind of, not criticize, but certainly request improvement on, it would be to know a bit more about where Apple's planning to go with the curriculum. Because, you know, I planned and I scheduled time for Learn to Code 1 and 2, and then, oh, suddenly there's a Book 3 as well, and I have to decide, well, am I going to drop something else to do Book 3, or am I just not going to do Book 3? And trying to retime the year on the fly is pretty challenging. So a wee bit more clarity on the kind of the intentions, the roadmap for the future would be helpful, I think. But in general, it's pretty good right now.
So you know, like, hey, there's going to be 5 books, there's going to be 6, and you know, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Was that anything else you want to add on your experiences so far?
No, I mean, I think the fun thing is, you know, if you're a teacher thinking about it, or you're interested in it, or even you're thinking about starting an after school club, just the app's free, the book, everything's free, right? None of this costs any money once you've bought the iPad, of course. Then, you know, go ahead and download it, see what's going on, work through the books yourself. And you'll find some of them challenging, right? And I think this is one of the things that is not obvious about it when you first look at it, is it looks like a toy until you start to try and solve the problems, and then you start to realize, oh, that is actually quite complicated, and yeah, I need to think about this pretty hard. And that's the fun of programming. So, yeah, download it, try it out, enjoy, and let me know how you get on.
We'll have links to things we talked about in the show notes, you know, the apps and things like that. Appreciate everybody listening this week. We love if you could rate us on iTunes. We're at itunes.com/out of school. And if you use an app like Overcast, we certainly would appreciate, you know, using the recommend feature and telling your friends about it as well, when you're at conferences and, you know, things like that. One other way, if you want to support us directly, we do have a Patreon page, and you can learn more about that at outofschool.net. You can, you know, give us $1 a month, $3 a month, $10 a month. We do have a thing where if you give us $3 or more a month, we put you on the dean's list at outofschool.net. That's just something fun. It's like, hey, thanks for supporting us. And we do like to thank people personally if they support us with over $10 a month reward. So this month, I want to thank Michael Slade, Envision Design LLC, Nicholas Cole Farrell, and Justin McGrath as well. So thanks to those folks for supporting us with a $10 a month donation. So, but you can learn more about our Patreon page at outofschool.net, and that's just a way to you know, help us pay for the hosting and new microphones and things like that. So thanks everybody for listening this week, and we will see you guys next week.